Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the July 5th through 11th edition of The Economist. We'll begin with The Leaders, a collection of five articles chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first, and this is the cover story, Big Beautiful Bunkers. Trumponomics 2.0 will erode the foundations of America's prosperity. Subheading, The Big Beautiful Bill is symptomatic of a wider malaise. Second, the tragedy of labor. Sir Keir Starmer is rapidly losing his authority. Subheading, as well as his hope of achieving much in office. Third, surveillance state. China is building an entire empire on data. Subheading, it will change the online economy and the evolution of artificial intelligence. Fourth, wrong direction. William Ruto is taking Kenya to a dangerous place. Subheading, the president's authoritarian instincts are propelling a spiral of violence. And fifth and finally, the new star power, how A-listers are shaking up the consumer goods business. Subheading, Hailey Bieber, Rihanna, and Ryan Reynolds are among a new cohort of celebrity entrepreneurs. Following the reading of those leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain. All, of course, as time allows. So, turning to that first leaders article, we have the title, Big Beautiful Bunkers. Trumponomics 2.0 will erode the foundations of America's prosperity. Subheading, The Big Beautiful Bill is symptomatic of a wider malaise. Was it just a false alarm? The panic about the world economy that followed President Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariffs in April has given way to growing optimism. Tariffs' inflationary effect has so far been muted. In private, bosses say they now expect trade fights to produce trade deals, not to be an end in themselves. Surveys show that business and consumer confidence, though low, is improving. And the S&P 500 index of stocks has hit a record high. And as we report, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, or BBB, that passed the Senate July 1st looks more like traditional tax cutting, spending slashing, Republicanism worthy of Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney than it does a MAGA fantasy. Suddenly, business leaders are again willing to see Mr. Trump as the populist from his first term, a man to be taken seriously but not literally. Unfortunately, the BBB, which Mr. Trump wants to sign into law by July 4th after we publish this, is likely to cast a shadow over this sunny picture. It illustrates the long-term damage Mr. Trump is doing to the foundations of America's economy. The bill's main effect is to extend the tax cuts for Mr. Trump's first term, which were due to expire. Republicans paint this as an extension of the status quo, yet they, like the Democrats before them, ignore the fact that the status quo is unsustainable. Over the past 12 months, America's budget deficit has been an astonishing 6.7% of GDP. If the bill passes, the deficit will remain around that level, and the country's debt to GDP ratio will, in about 2 years, exceed the 106% reached after the Second World War. Revenue from tariffs will help, but not enough to stop the ratio rising, meaning that the drift toward crisis will continue. To the extent the bill tightens the belt, it does so in the wrong places. As life expectancies rise and population ages, America should trim handouts to the old, for example, by raising the retirement age. Instead, pensioners are getting a tax break, and Republicans are cutting Medicaid, health insurance for the hard up. Some sensible measures include reducing the ability of states to game the system for more federal cash. Yet according to official projections, the overall effect will be to add nearly 12 million to the number of Americans without health insurance. That's a scandalous number for the world's richest big economy. Many of those who lose coverage will fall foul of new requirements that recipients must work. Such rules have in the past created an obstacle course of paperwork for claimants while failing to boost employment. More savings come from repealing tax credits for clean energy passed under President Joe Biden. The credits were littered with protectionist Buy American requirements that this newspaper opposed. But because Congress abhors carbon pricing, nothing will replace them. The country will once again lack a federal policy for decarbonization, and its greenhouse gas emissions will be greater than they would have been. Mr. Trump's nostalgia for fossil fuels ignores the potential of renewables to make energy much more abundant. That is foolish when the race for artificial general intelligence is in part a race for the electricity necessary to train massive models. Even the way the bill was passed reveals America's creeping dysfunction. The BBB is gargantuan because governing parties very rarely get more than one chance a year to pass a tax and spending bill with just 51 votes in the Senate, rather than the 60 needed to circumvent the filibuster. In such a big bill, important reforms are poorly scrutinized and a lot of pork can be used to buy the support of congressmen. Optimists acknowledge some or all of this, but argue that economic growth will wipe out all those worries. Faster growth would ease the burden of debt, benefit the poor through more jobs and higher wages, and make political dysfunction seem economically irrelevant. Sure enough, the administration projects nearly 5% more output over the next 4 years. Yet it's wrong to expect this bill will create a growth boom. The tax cuts in BBB that are already in effect offer little fresh stimulus, and tariffs are an offsetting force. In any case, interest rates are three times their level when Mr. Trump last cut taxes, and the Federal Reserve is more likely to balance looser fiscal policy with tweaks in its monetary stance. Supply-side tax cuts will help boost investment, but account for just 8% of the total by cost. Many new tax cuts, including exemptions for tips and overtime, are gimmicks. The administration's deregulation agenda could help, but only on the margins. In fact, America's geyser of debt issuance will increasingly harm growth. In normal times, public debt crowds out private investment, raising the cost of capital for new projects like data centers, and the cost of a sudden fiscal adjustment forced on America by bond markets would be vast. Goldman Sachs Bank reckons that if Congress postpones fiscal tightening for another decade, it may then need to cut spending or raise taxes by an annual 5.5% of GDP to stabilize debt to GDP. That's more than the austerity endured by the Eurozone after its sovereign debt crisis in the 2010s. If that proved too hard for legislators, America might resort to tactics used after the Second World War, inflation, and financial repression. Voterama leads to a borrower drama. The BBB's neglect of the long term is part of a wider malaise. Riding high on America's economic might and undoubted negotiating leverage, Mr. Trump ignores the foundations of America's success. He has renewed his attacks on the Fed, adding another threat to economic stability. His defunding of scientific research will harm American innovation. His cavalier approach to the rule of law makes America a riskier place to invest. And despite the moderation of his trade war, the average tariff rate is still at its highest in a century, and trade policy uncertainty is a burden. Even as American assets boom in dollar terms, they've fallen behind when priced in foreign currencies. An 11% fall in the dollar this year reflects long-term risks to the American economy that are real and growing. And our second Leaders article is titled The Tragedy of Labor, Labor with a capital L. Sir Keir Starmer is rapidly losing his authority, as well as his hope of achieving much in office. The first birthday of Britain's Labour government on July 4th will be a miserable, cakeless affair. The party's polling is dreadful, trailing Reform UK, an insurgency from the right led by Nigel Farage. promises to cut hospital waiting lists, build more houses, and stop migrant boats are off track. And on July 1st, Sir Keir Starmer was humiliated by a huge rebellion as Labour MPs gutted a bill to cut sickness and disability benefits. In Parliament, the next day, his Chancellor wept and yields on British debt soared. The Prime Minister has never looked weaker. Labour came to power hoping to be a beacon for European and American centrists beset by the populist merchants of division and chaos like Mr. Farage. Sir Keir boasted that he would attack Britain's structural crises by combining a technocratic cabinet with a mighty parliamentary majority. In place of conservative gimmicks, he would engineer deep reforms. Growth would return, public services would stir, and Britain's faith in the political system would be restored. This week's rebellion shows how Sir Keir has failed. True, Britain is more stable than when the Tories culled several prime ministers in a bloodfest to rival Squid Game. Yet even as Sir Keir has shepherded Britain back into the European fold, nannied President Donald Trump, and backed Ukraine and NATO, the crisis at home has only deepened. Britain is stuck in its longest period of economic stagnation since the 1930s. The public finances do not add up. The cost of servicing debt as a share of GDP is the highest since 1987. In the 1980s, only 12% of voters thought the prime minister would put party before country. Today, only 12% expect Labour to put country first. On election morning, Sir Keir called trust in government, quote, the battle that defines our age, end quote. Under Labour, trust is at a 40-year low. One error has been for Sir Keir to court political pain for little gain, as the welfare debacle shows. Britain is suffering a steeper rise in benefits than other Western countries, owing partly to a surge in young claimants citing poor mental health. Labour should have dealt with the fundamental causes and managed the politics by offsetting cuts in one area of welfare with gains in another. Instead, the reforms were a cosmetic measure to flatter the public finances by trimming just £5.5 billion of annual savings from an expected total of £66 billion by 2030. Even that progress has been undone by the rebellion. Across government, Sir Keir tweaks systems that need reinvention and shores up institutions that should be demolished. Labour's reforms to the Planning Code, Brexit, the National Health Service, Whitehall, and taxation are all too timid. As a result, the government has blown its stock of political capital on measures that are often sensible, frequently unpopular, but invariably too small, shallow, and slow to make a difference. Another of Sir Keir's errors has been to shy away from making the big argument. The case for reforming welfare should come naturally to a leader who has preached blue-collar values of hard graft and minding the pennies. But the former star barrister instead fell back on the weak, contingent case that his hands are forced by the public finances, only then to destroy his credibility by backing down. Having run a small target election campaign that included as few details as possible, Sir Keir has never sought to tell voters why he wants power, at least not beyond saying that it should help him be reelected. And a last disappointment has been his failure to equip Labour to grapple with the mood in the country. Britons know that their economy is stagnant, but they also balk at attempts to fix it. They tell pollsters they want higher spending but oppose higher taxes. They want lower welfare bills in general, but oppose benefit cuts in particular. Naturally, Kemi Badenoch, the conservative leader, and Mr. Farage play into this with talk of a smaller, leaner state, even as they line up to oppose cuts to goodies that voters treasure. Labour MPs were elected to resolve these contradictions. Under Sir Keir, they've been unwilling to confront their voters. Twice, MPs have shown they will not control spending, first by protesting against a cut to heating subsidies, and then by rebelling on welfare. Labour's supposed iron grip on the public finances is feeble. Many MPs talk about loosening the fiscal rules again so as to borrow even more. They have learned the long lessons from Liz Truss, whose 49 days as prime minister in 2022 tanked the bond market. The conclusion should not be just that Ms. Truss was a fool, but also that Britain, a country with high debt, weak growth, and borrowing costs above the G7 average, will struggle to retain the faith of its creditors. In theory, 1 year is too soon to write off Sir Keir. Even Sir Tony Blair in his pomp was dealt a bloody nose by backbenchers over welfare reform. The Prime Minister could yet confront his MPs with the hard truth that, without a transformation in Britain's growth prospects, the social democracy to which they aspire is a mirage. Britain is lucky that the solutions to many of its problems could be fixed by Parliament. Deeper welfare reform, a predictable rules-based planning system, a new property tax and VAT regime, and visas geared to productive newcomers. Such a course would bring growth and help refute Mr. Farage's argument that the old parties are inert in the face of decline. That sinking feeling. More probably, Sir Keir will sink further. His government appears to have lost confidence among investors, and his chancellor's credibility has vaporized. It's unclear how long she will survive in office. After this week, the Prime Minister will struggle to enforce discipline in Parliament. Rather than try to pass ambitious legislation, he's more likely to try to soothe irate MPs and buy off his base with a thin smear of jam today. A Labour Party that chooses popularity over hard reforms will end up with neither. Deeper crisis could shake Britain out of its stupor, but if the malaise continues, it may well be Mr. Farage who rides to power promising change. That should be Labour's warning to centrists everywhere. And our third leader's article is titled Surveillance State. China is building an entire empire on data. Subheading, it will change the online economy and the evolution of artificial intelligence. China's 1.1 billion internet users churn out more data than anyone else on Earth. So does the country's vast network of facial recognition cameras. As autonomous cars speed down roads and flying ones crisscross the skies, the quality and value of the information flowing from emerging technologies will soar. Yet the volume of data is not the only thing setting China apart. The government is also embedding data management into the economy and national security. That has implications for China and holds lessons for democracies. China's planners see data as a factor of production alongside labor, capital, and land. Xi Jinping, the president, has called data a foundational resource with a revolutionary impact on international competition. The scope of this vision is unparalleled, affecting everything from civil liberties to the profits of internet firms and China's pursuit of the lead in artificial intelligence. Mr. Xi's vision is being enacted fast. In 2021, China released rules modeled on Europe's General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. Now it's diverging quickly from Western norms. All levels of government are to marshal the data resources they have, a sweeping project to assess the data piles at state-owned firms is underway. The idea is to value them as assets and add them to balance sheets or trade them on state-run exchanges. On June 3rd, the State Council released new rules to compel all levels of government to share data. Another big step is a digital ID due to be launched July 15th. Under this, the central authorities could control a ledger of every person's websites and apps. Connecting someone's name with their online activity will become harder for the big tech firms, which used to run the system. They will see only an anonymized stream of digits and letters. Chillingly, however, the ledger may one day act as a panopticon for the state. China's ultimate goal appears to be to create an integrated national data ocean, covering not just consumers, but industrial and state activity too. The advantages are obvious and include economies of scale for training AI models and lower barriers to entry for small new firms. Some of the disadvantages are equally clear, however. The state has a poor record of managing personal data. Shanghai's police lost 1 billion records to a hacker. If private firms lose control over the data they create, profits could suffer, diminishing the incentives to innovate. Although the digital ID scheme may supersede the existing clunkier online surveillance system, in which low-level enforcers abuse their enormous powers, the new approach looks a lot like a paradise for Big Brother. Most countries are grappling with how to manage and control data. According to some reports, the Trump administration may consider hiring Palantir, a private tech firm, to consolidate government data pools. The European Union may have to update its GDPR rules. India's Aadhaar system for IDs emphasizes privacy at the possible expense of boosting the economy. All countries need scale and efficacy in data management, yet for democracies the task is harder because they must build in checks and balances that safeguard property rights, privacy, and civil liberties. As it embraces its vast experiment, China will put less weight on such things and could build an efficient and dystopian system of surveillance. For decades, it has been a fast follower of Western innovations. If China now races ahead in showing the financial value of its national data ocean, its method of centralization will pose not just an economic challenge, but also a political one. And our fourth leader's article is titled Wrong Direction. William Ruto is taking Kenya to a dangerous place. Subheading, the president's authoritarian instincts are propelling a spiral of violence. For the past 2 decades, if you searched a map of Africa for a country that was relatively stable politically and successful economically, one stood out, Kenya. Home to 57 million people from 40 ethnic groups, the East African country has grown steadily and sustained a largely peaceful democracy. But now the picture's looking bleak. Kenyans are increasingly discontented and venting their anger in the streets. President William Ruto, elected in 2022 on a promise to improve the lives of ordinary Kenyans, has responded to demonstrations with brutality and censorship. A spiral of riot and repression is eroding civil liberties and may jeopardize economic reforms. Mr. Ruto must change tack. The latest ominous sign came June 25th when 19 people were killed and hundreds injured after police opened fire on protests. The government banned live television coverage of the mayhem until a court intervened. The protesters were furious at the recent death of an opposition blogger in police custody, and they were also marking the anniversary of anti-government demonstrations in 2024, during which at least 63 people were killed and many more arrested or abducted. Kenyans' fury reflects their country's deeper problems. In contrast with the past, protesters are not divided along ethnic lines, but united by frustration over their poor living standards and their lack of opportunities. Last year's demonstrations were named the Gen Z protests because they were led by young people outraged at a planned tax rise by a government that wastes money and creates too few jobs for them. The official response to bloodshed last year was indifference. Following the latest killings, the Interior Minister has denounced what he calls a coup attempt by criminal anarchists and commended the police on their restraint. The more repressive the government grows, the more young Kenyans question its legitimacy. Their country, which once set a fine example to the rest of Africa, now offers a how-to guide on smothering dissent. It could get worse. Unrest could grow more violent and be met with more deadly force and more midnight abductions of government critics by hooded men wielding batons and handcuffs. The police insist they're not to blame, but survivors say they were tortured and questioned about the protests. Kenya has a reasonably solid judiciary, but such abuses undermine confidence in the rule of law and deter investment. Several global companies have already left or scaled back operations. Worse still, Mr. Ruto's inability to create a consensus could delay or derail much-needed economic reforms. After last year's protests, he backed down and scrapped the plan to raise taxes. Yet the state needs more revenues if it's to do its job properly while reducing the public debt and promoting growth. The best way out of the spiral would be to take the protesters' demands seriously. The government should rein in its security forces, end the abductions of dissidents, and prosecuting those responsible for those killing protesters. It should make a visible effort to improve public services while curbing corruption, state profligacy, and ostentatious consumption by the political elite. Kenyans are likely to accept higher taxes only if they feel more confident that their hard-earned cash will not be stolen or squandered. The elusive alternative. Given the damage to Mr. Ruto's reputation over the past 3 years, a less tainted successor would have a better chance of getting the reforms Kenya needs. So the president should not stand for re-election in 2027. Alas, he's unlikely to step aside. Kenya does not have a strong opposition candidate to challenge him. Unless one emerges, there's a grave risk Mr. Ruto will continue to take his country backwards. And our fifth and final leader's article is titled The New Star Power, How A-Listers Are Shaking Up the Consumer Goods Business. Hailey Bieber, Rihanna, and Ryan Reynolds are among a new cohort of celebrity entrepreneurs. Celebrities are venturing beyond the billboard and the big screen and into big business. Hailey Bieber, a model married to Justin, recently sold Rode, her makeup brand, in a deal valued as much as $1 billion. Skims, a shapewear label founded by Kim Kardashian, a reality TV star, makes $1 billion in annual sales and is expected to list on the stock market soon. Rihanna is now a billionaire, not directly because of her music, but thanks to Fenty Beauty, her makeup label. Ryan Reynolds, a Hollywood actor, is active in everything from telecoms to online privacy. Surprisingly, many of these superstar businesses have become a source of innovative new consumer products. Celebrities have long used their fame to peddle things. Michael Jordan, a basketball player, is thought to have made over $1.5 billion from his partnership with Nike over the past 40 years. Nespresso has reportedly paid George Clooney more than $40 million to have his mug selling its coffee. 2 decades ago, Hulk Hogan, a professional wrestler, helped market the Hulkster cheeseburger, pre-cooked and frozen for your convenience. The practice continues. This week, President Donald Trump launched Victory 4547, a line of fragrances for men and women priced at $249, having launched Fight, Fight, Fight at $199 last year. By contrast, the new superstar brands put the A-list into capitalist. Ms. Bieber and company are involved in operations and hold equity stakes of varying sizes in the underlying businesses. Many celebs have begun to rethink the value of traditional endorsement and licensing deals. Social media now give them a line straight to their fans. Direct-to-consumer distribution, meanwhile, has made getting a product to market easier than ever, given that the real money's in building and owning a brand rather than advertising. Why not launch one instead? This thinking, in turn, is altering the life cycle of consumer goods. Just as pharmaceutical giants acquire biotech startups to refresh their drug pipelines, so consumer giants are buying up the most successful celebrity brands. The match makes sense. The hardest part of building a brand is the first 100,000 sales, but the A-list has a fan base that is well disposed toward them and their wares. Once a celebrity brand gets off the ground, a consumer giant has the production and distribution networks to help it grow. Hence the series of deals. Among the first was Apple's acquisition of Beats Electronics, a headphones and streaming business co-founded by Dr. Dre, a music producer. Many were shocked when the tech giant, which prides itself on in-house research and design, paid around $3 billion for the brand in 2014. More recently, Diageo, a drink maker, has bought a tequila firm owned by Mr. Clooney in a deal valued at around $1 billion, and a gin distiller, partly owned by Mr. Reynolds, for up to $610 million. Obviously, a famous name's not enough on its own to get a second-rate product flying off the shelves. You need only peer into the bargain bin in any cosmetic shop to spot the remainders of Rosie Huntington Whiteley's beauty products or Sarah Jessica Parker's scents. Some of Mr. Trump's newest offerings may soon join them. According to a perfume review website, Victory 4547 for men is, quote, not particularly memorable, end quote. Shoppers today are quick to review products on social media. Fans might try a new lipstick or t-shirt produced by a celebrity, but they won't buy it a second time if they're disappointed. At their best, celebrity brands are innovative, creative, and lucrative for their owners. Yet, just like show business, brutal flops are possible too. And just past the halfway mark in today's broadcast, we remind you you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading from the July 5th through 11th edition of The Economist. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin as usual with a lead article on the United States. This one's called Speedy Justices. The Supreme Court keeps helping Donald Trump. Subheading, the president is using emergency cases to expand his power. The Supreme Court decided just 55 fully argued or merits cases in the term that ended on June 27th, the lowest total since the Civil War, except for the COVID curtailed term of 2020. Yet the justices have been busier than ever. President Donald Trump's use of the court's emergency docket has forced the justices to review extraordinary assertions of executive power on a speeded-up basis. Of the 15 emergency applications that have been resolved, 4 still pending, 12 have gone Mr. Trump's way. Last month, the court granted the government's plea to deport undocumented immigrants to South Sudan and Libya without giving them a chance to argue they would face torture there. It also stopped a government ethics watchdog from obtaining records to the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, and gave DOGE authority to continue getting access to Americans' Social Security data. In other cases, the court sided with Mr. Trump's decision to freeze teacher grants for DEI-related reasons, bar transgender soldiers, and end deportation protections for nearly 1 million migrants. The justices did rule against the president on 3 occasions. They stopped cancellation of a $2 billion foreign aid payment and ordered the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a mistakenly deported Maryland man. They also told the government to give a group of Venezuelan men due process before being removed under the Alien Enemies Act, an 18th century law. Mr. Trump's emergency strategy at the Supreme Court has buoyed his agenda and authority. He's benefited from the outlook of a conservative majority on the court that promoted executive power before Mr. Trump came along. For Kate Shaw, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, the court's decisions seem, quote, animated by a virtually boundless conception of executive power and of the power of the Supreme Court, end quote. Ms. Shaw's impression that the justices are arrogating power to themselves and Mr. Trump while stepping on their lower court colleagues' robes stems from Trump versus CASA, C-A-S-A, a rare emergency case in which the justices opted to slow down and hold an oral argument. By a 6-3 vote, the court stripped district court judges of the power to issue nationwide injunctions, the tool they've been using to stymie Mr. Trump's most aggressive policies and policies of Democratic presidents before him. Samuel Bray, a law professor at the University of Chicago, credits Justice Amy Coney Barrett with holding together a fissiparious majority to end these potent injunctions. Jack Goldsmith, a law professor at Harvard, says the emergency docket is likely to remain center court for Mr. Trump's attempts to keep his agenda moving. As Mr. Goldsmith sees it, interim orders have become, quote, the merits docket for presidential power, end quote. The High Court is defining the contours of Mr. Trump's power on a rolling basis and often provisionally, but consequentially, shunting questions of executive power to the emergency docket, also known as the shadow docket, may come at a cost. Cases there are often resolved without a word of reasoning. When explanations are included, they can be cursory, even when the justices herald a major change. Steve Vladek, a law professor at Georgetown University, who has written critically about the court's use of the shadow docket, finds no rhyme or reason in these rulings other than enabling lawless behavior by the Trump administration. To Mr. Vladek and other critics, the court has too often prioritized outcomes over both principle and established legal procedures. In Trump v. Wilcox, for example, the court considered whether Mr. Trump lawfully removed the heads of two federal agencies. The women were protected by laws of Congress barring presidents from removing them without cause, and by Humphrey's Executor v. United States, a 1935 decision upholding restrictions on presidential firing. Yet, in May, the six-justice majority temporarily allowed Mr. Trump's move, strongly suggesting this will be their final decision as well. The order in Wilcox acknowledges that the sackings were, quote, prohibited by statute, unquote, but it lets the president carry them out anyway because the government faces greater risk of harm than the removed officer. There was no mention of potential damage to Congress's authority as a co-equal branch. Large language justice. By the numbers, this term looks similar to the previous three shaped by the current 6-3 conservative majority. On the merits docket, the justices were unanimous 42% of the time, slightly lower than the average of 44.5% since 2006. Since some of these decisions involve controversial matters such as alleged reverse discrimination against straight workers and lawsuits against American gun makers, and the 10-6-3 decisions were not all conservative wins, the liberals teamed up with the supermajority's more moderate troika, Chief Justice Roberts and Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, four times to inter alia save free preventive care under the Affordable Care Act and preserve the Federal Communications Commission's Universal Service Fund for broadband in your rural America. For The Economist, the term was also notable for the debut of SCOTUSBOT, a work-in-progress AI tool that sought to predict outcomes in high-profile cases by analyzing briefs and oral arguments, among other data. One of its 10 predictions was a case the justices opted to revisit next term. Of the remaining 9, SCOTUSBOT was spot on with 6. It was equivocal on 1 and confused about another. It didn't get that Trump versus Casa was about injunctions, and wrong on a 3rd. After a summer of study and self-improvement, we expect our bot to return with the justices on the first Monday in October. The one case where SCOTUSBOT fell down was a curious result. Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton involved a challenge to a Texas law that requires age verification before adults may view online pornography. No justices disputed the importance of shielding children from graphic sexual material. The divide was over whether verifying users' age with the privacy and surveillance exposures this entails constitutes a content-based restriction on adults' protected speech that triggers strict scrutiny, which requires the state to show that the law is the least restrictive means to reach a compelling state interest. The majority shrugged off several Supreme Court precedents, which signal that it does. Free Speech Coalition was one of 3 culture war cases involving children, decided 6-3 along ideological lines. In United States versus Skrmetti, the court rejected a challenge to Tennessee's law banning puberty blockers and hormone therapy for transgender teenagers, finding it's not a sex-based classification that demands heightened scrutiny under the 14th Amendment. While Justices Ketanji Brown Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor would have struck down Tennessee's law, Justice Elena Kagan took a more measured approach, recognizing that just because the law classifies by sex does not mean that it, or similar laws in 2 dozen other states, must fall. It means bans on treatments for trans teenagers must offer proof of an important government interest and a reasonable means of achieving it, she argued. Perhaps the most notable departure from established law occurred in Mahmoud versus Taylor, where Justice Samuel Alito recognized the right of religious parents to take their children out of LGBTQ-inclusive school classes. Under previous high court rulings, school practices that only incidentally burden religious practice were permitted under the First Amendment. Don Herzog, a law professor at the University of Michigan, warns that Mahmoud may pressure school districts to get all LGBTQ plus stuff out of the schools, and pronto. That's a quote. The justices' summer holidays could be busy with the fallout from Trump versus Casa as plaintiffs pursue alternative strategies to keep Mr. Trump's attack on birthright citizenship at bay, and those appeals, plus untold others, ascend to the Supreme Court. The rolling emergency docket that has become a feature of this law-stretching presidency is not going anywhere. And moving next to the section on the Americas, we have the title Elbows Down. Canada makes a first concession to Donald Trump. Subheading, Mark Carney is hoping it does not lead to more demands. Lately, Mark Carney has profited from firmly ditching his predecessor's policies. At the start of the year, during his campaign to run the Liberal Party, he promised to throw out the consumer-facing portion of Canada's carbon tax and backed smoothly away from progressive positions that had been miring the Liberals in culture wars. This made him look pragmatic and serious. It helped him win the party leadership and take the Liberals to an unprecedented fourth term in power. On June 29th, he performed a similar maneuver, jettisoning Canada's Digital Services Tax, or DST, enacted in the last parliament, hours before it was due to come into effect. On June 27th, Donald Trump had threatened to abandon trade talks if the DST was not dropped. Mr. Carney was swift to oblige. The levy would have collected 3% of local revenue from tech firms operating in Canada, including American giants like Google, Uber, Meta, and Amazon. But unlike Mr. Carney's previous reversal, scrapping the DST in exchange for the privilege of merely negotiating with Mr. Trump may prove costly. After the fact, Mr. Carney suggested he always expected to dump the DST as part of a larger deal with Mr. Trump, which he hopes will remove American tariffs of 50% on Canadian steel and aluminum and 25% on cars. But he was surely counting on dropping the DST as part of an agreement that eliminated those tariffs, not as a mere table stakes to keep talking. Other countries have refused to eliminate their digital services taxes in the face of Mr. Trump's demands. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer was the first leader to make a pact to reduce some American tariffs, but Britain's 2% DST remained in place. France was the first European country to impose a DST in 2019. It has signaled it will not rescind the tax unless an agreement on the taxation of multinationals is reached by the OECD, a club comprised mainly of rich countries. Mr. Trump's administration was not the first to grumble about the DST. His predecessor Joe Biden complained about it to Justin Trudeau, Canada's previous prime minister. So how did Mr. Trump's vexation cause a law passed in Canada's parliament to be summarily scrapped? It was probably the fact that his tariffs are already hurting Canadian workers. Unemployment rose to 7% in May, its highest rate, barring the pandemic years, since 2016, according to Statistics Canada. Exports of cars to the United States fell by 23% month on month in April, when Mr. Trump's tariffs were first applied to vehicles following cuts in production. Unifor, the union that represents most of Canada's auto workers, says 6,000 of its members have been laid off due to slowed or halted production. In steelmaking, 1,000 Canadian workers have already lost their jobs, and the damage is showing up in the overall trade figures, too. Exports from Canada to the United States have been collapsing. Goods exports over Canada's southern border are down by 26% since their peak in January. Mr. Trump's spokesperson, Caroline Leavitt, bolstered his reputation as an ungracious winner after Mr. Carney's concession. Quote, "It's very simple. Prime Minister Carney in Canada caved to President Trump and the United States of America," end quote. None of this should stick to Mr. Carney if he can fashion an agreement with the United States that eliminates or significantly reduces the tariffs by July 21st, the deadline both men have set for their bilateral talks. But there's no guarantee that this concession will stifle further demands. Mr. Trump has a record of exploiting weakness, and Canada's economy is one-tenth the size of America's. He's also offered shifting reasons for crippling Canada with tariffs, from minuscule flows of fentanyl to a trade deficit built on America's thirst for Canadian oil, or protectionist measures that insulate Canada's dairy farmers from American competition. Nor has he given up on his biggest designs on Canada. Canadians can pay tariffs and $71 billion for ballistic missile defense under Mr. Trump's Golden Dome, or they could agree to become the first 51st state. It's up to them, Mr. Trump shrugged as he left the G7 summit in Alberta on June 16th. And turning next to the section on Middle East and Africa, we have an article titled, "Nice Deal on Paper, a Peace Agreement in Africa That Will Probably Not Bring Peace." Subheading, "The Truce Signed by Congo and Rwanda Leaves Out Some Important Details." It was an unlikely picture. On June 27th, the foreign ministers of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo stood in the Oval Office next to Donald Trump, America's president, who hailed the peace deal they had just signed. Quote, "We're here today to celebrate a glorious triumph," said Mr. Trump. "The violence and destruction comes to an end, and the entire region begins a new chapter of hope and opportunity, harmony, prosperity, and peace." That was, to put it mildly, an overstatement. True, the deal is a sign that the two neighbors, which have engaged in a long-running conflict in eastern Congo, see benefits in showing they're willing to make up the prospect of investment by America, which is keen to secure access to mineral wealth in the region, may have tipped the scales toward an agreement. Yet it's unclear whether the deal will do more than just signal goodwill. The fighting has its origins in the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. Back then, some of those implicated in the slaughter fled to Congo, then called Zaire, to escape troops led by Paul Kagame, now Rwanda's president. In 1996, Rwandan troops and allied militias invaded Congo, claiming it was harboring genocidaires. This sparked two brutal regional wars that killed millions of people in the late 90s and early 2000s, and the fighting has never stopped completely. During the most recent escalation in January, the M23 militia, backed by Rwanda, captured territory including Goma and Bukavu, the two biggest cities in eastern Congo. Congo's army found itself outgunned. M23's relentless advance raised the specter of another regional war. But a mix of diplomatic and economic pressure by America and Qatar, an important partner for Rwanda, appears to have succeeded in halting the advance and forcing the two countries to the negotiating table. Mr. Trump hopes the new agreement will pave the way for American investors to make money from Congo's vast mineral resources. America is negotiating a separate minerals deal with Congo's government that could give investors access to Congolese mines. The deal is similar to an earlier agreement mediated by Angola that fell through in December when Mr. Kagame failed to turn up for the signing. It calls for Rwandan troops to leave Congolese territory within 90 days. Congo, for its part, is supposed to neutralize the FDLR, a militia that originally included army officers involved in the 1994 genocide and which Rwanda still sees as a threat. Will any of this come to pass? The agreement can work, says Joshua Walker of the Congo Research Group at New York University. Quote, "but only if the parties engage in good faith, which is far from a given," end quote. Congo says the deal at last addresses the Rwandan occupation of the country's east. Teresa Kayikwamba Wagner, Congo's foreign minister expects it will, quote, gradually contribute to defusing tensions, end quote. Rwanda, though, may be happy for M23 to continue occupying eastern Congo, helped by its own troops. It's unlikely to make good on its part of the deal without either significant recompense or the threat of heavy sanctions. Mr. Trump has promised very severe penalties if either party breaks its side of the bargain, but that may not be enough to sway Mr. Kagame. Just as worrying, the deal is vague on the future of M23, which has never officially admitted that it is backed by Rwanda, and on the fate of the parts of eastern Congo that the militia occupies. A separate set of talks between M23 and Congo, also brokered by Qatar, is proving thorny. On June 28th, the group's spokesman said that the rebels were going nowhere. In Goma, where human rights groups have accused M23 of atrocities, including torture and gang rape, residents are hopeful but wary. "We don't want this agreement to be a masquerade like the others," says a 28-year-old student. "What we want is peace for M23 to leave." And turning next to the section on Europe, we have an article titled Inside Russia. In Putin's Moscow, a summer of death and distraction. Subheading, amid festivals and flowers, the capital is far from the war. Watch Russian television or listen to Vladimir Putin's chilling speeches, and Russia is a besieged fortress struggling to preserve humanity against the decadent West, defending the traditional values of family life and defying death by its readiness to sacrifice life. Walk down Moscow streets, however, and it looks nothing like a city in the grip of a death cult. But neither did Berlin in the early 1940s with its cabarets and heady consumption. The Russian capital is enjoying a three-month festival called Summer in Moscow. It has been masterminded by Sergei Sobyanin, the mayor, and implemented by a team of creative young designers. Most of it's free. Pink, white, and blue petunias in pots, amphitheaters of wildflower boxes, and exotic plants fill every space. Bridges and terraces are decked with floral displays. "The city looks like one giant flower bed," says Tatiana Malkina, a journalist. The center is a display of paradisical life, with gardens, verandas, open-air classes in cooking and painting, artisan ice cream kiosks, and petanque and tennis. The festival is the culmination of years of renovation and infrastructure improvement. Around the Kremlin, a horseshoe ring of boulevards has become a chain of open-air stages, operetta on Tverskoy, art shows on Strastnoy, and circus on Svestnoy. All this easy pleasure coexists with intensifying ideological campaign. On June 12th, Russia Day and a national holiday, Mr. Putin inspected military men and women in the Kremlin's columns, Hall of the Order of St. Catherine. "The meaning of today," he told them, "lies in the immortality of the Russian people, our state, our motherland, Russia. And the road to this immortality lies through the victories you and your comrades in arms are blazing." A female officer replied by extolling, quote, "the moral purity of the army and of the life of our people in the country," end quote. Repression is tightening too. On June 29th, the Kremlin published a new order which classifies information about any preparations for the mobilization of society or government institutions as a state secret. It also prohibits sharing data from vast arrays of civilian-state interaction, from trade to economics to science. Contact with the West is perilous. Prison sentences of up to 8 years chill debate, economic management, as well as technical research, are all sure to suffer. The prominence of ideology in Russia has increased in proportion to the number of Russian casualties from the war in Ukraine, but unlike communism or fascism, the besetting ideologies of the 20th century, Mr. Putin's surrogate offers no vision of the future. It consists of ultra-conservative, anti-Western, militaristic, and millenarian tenets. The function of this new technology is to legitimize the war and the growing size of Russia's cemeteries. Mr. Putin argues that a struggle of civilizations is going on against the depraved West. The feudal deaths are heroic feats. Allegiance to ideology is a marker of loyalty to the regime, not a matter of conviction, one Moscow entrepreneur explains. More than ever, consumption, repression, and war are simultaneous. Memories of past conflicts have been redacted. Bolotnaya Square, the site of anti-Putin rallies in 2011 and 12, hosts free creative and sporting events for the young. A statue of Pushkin, a focal point for protests since Soviet times, is fenced off by newly planted cypresses. The shrine to Boris Nemtsov, a liberal politician who was killed in 2015 by the Kremlin, is overwhelmed by a flower arrangement. Muscovites are well aware of the schizophrenia. Alexandra Ostakova, a photographer, says the experience is psychedelic. Quote, "You can walk along beautifully decorated streets and then turn the corner and see a line of people outside a prison queuing up to hand parcels to those who've been jailed for protesting against the war." End quote. While some 300,000 have fled the city, most have stayed. Their voices are rarely heard. Dmitry Muratov, a 2021 Nobel Peace Prize laureate, says, quote, "People with whom I live and work in Moscow are stripped of their right to protest, other than their last word in court before their... They have no possibility to express their repulsion at the bloodshed," end quote. One journalist says neither she nor her friends are taking part of the masquerade, but they draw comfort from the fact that the city is full of flowers rather than checkpoints in the swastika-like Z symbol of the war. The mayor could be running around the city with an assault rifle hunting draft dodgers. He isn't. He emphatically chooses life over death as he understands it, which is pitifully narrow. That's a quotation. Summers in Russia are short. Come autumn, the stages will be dismantled and the flowers removed. No one knows what next year's performance will look like. For now, people are living the only life they have and doing their best to ignore Mr. Putin's strange obsessions. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the July 5th through 11th edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.